Freestyling the anchor, I'm write that shit. Freestyling the anchor, anchor. Freestyling the anchor, I'm write that shit. Freestyling the anchor. Hey, hey.
Yo.
It's Ergo.
It is indeed.
I'm Kiss.
I'm Damon.
And we're back doing what we do, reshaping culture for the more liberatory and creative.
And we got a special one for you today. We have the thoughtful, the caring, the brilliant, the prolific Robin DG Kelly with us. Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to be honest, Dame. I was waiting for a couple more adjectives. It seemed like you were really
more
on a roll. Yeah, what do you
got? I have more to give.
Throw a couple more in there.
The prophetic, the illustrious, the honorable.
The bespectacled.
The caring, the nurturing, the humble, the sensitive, the tender. If I didn't say brilliant again, honestly, all jokes aside, literally one of the most brilliant people I've ever encountered.
So we're just assuming you know who Robin is, but maybe we should give a little bit of a bio. Robin is a brilliant historian, organizer, thinker, writer, and professor of American history at UCLA. In this conversation, you hear how he understands, you know, the work of our moment, our context, connected to this larger socio-political history. And honestly, it felt kind of good to get that connection reflected back from someone who's really studied this work. We also talked about his experience growing up and how it brought him to this work and to his politic. We connected it to the current moment. It was just a wonderful conversation with Robin.
It's always a gift to share space with Robin. He's not only been a mentor to me and us, but to so many throughout movement over the past few decades. And so he's so generous and gracious with his time. Speaking of which, not too long after this conversation, he joined us for a screening of the 1 Million Experiments film on UCLA's campus and helped host and moderate the post-screening conversation. And that was not the last opportunity for people to catch 1 Million Experiments.
Yeah, that's right. We're continuing to tour this land and beyond, screening the film, hosting conversations, leading performances. They're going great. It's been really, really fun. We're going to be in New York the weekend after this episode drops for the Beyond the Bars conference doing a screening. That's April 5th through 7th. On April 11th, back in the Chicagoland area, we're doing a screening at Dominican University in River Forest. We're also going to have a bunch more Chicago screenings coming up, so keep an eye out for that. And then we're actually going to be back in New York at the end of April. We're doing a screening on the 24th and then figuring out some other details beyond that. So make sure you follow the Respare Media Instagram at Respare Media for all that information. Over the course of the rest of the year, we're going to be in the Twin Cities, Detroit, Seattle, Puerto Rico, many other spaces. So make sure you keep an eye out. And if you want to bring this film to you, either with us in conversation or you just want to watch a good movie, hit us up, contact at respairemedia.com. We want this film to be in your space, contributing to the work you're doing and helping make new possibilities more possible.
All right, let's get to it. The one, the only, Robin DG Kelly.
Here we go.
All right, everybody, I'm over the moon. We are honored, we are humbled. We are eager, we are excited to have the brilliant, the gracious, the loving, the phenomenal, the one and only Robin DG Kelly is back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
Boom.
We're trying out some new ones, you know?
You cracked me up.
Robin, it's so good to see you. It means so much that you made this time to be here with us. And we're going to start our conversation, as we always do, with our tradition of a two-part question centered around time. So define time how you will, this day, this hour, this season, this lifetime. In this time, how is the world treating you and how are you treating the world?
Well, first of all, just being here with you all has made my day, my week, my month, actually 2024. It's important because, you know, I think of the space that you've created as a space that's really, really serious about the world, but at the same time centers joy and community and conversation without expectations. You know, it changes everything, you know, for me. It has been a really hard year. Mostly because, you know, we're witnessing in real time a genocide. And, you know, I've spent my whole writing life in some ways kind of either directly dealing with or indirectly dealing with the question of genocide. And for the first time It's in real time before everyone. And still, we live in a country that's in denial. So that's going on. At the same time, in terms of how the world's treating me, I've come to realize that I think I'm too generous with my time. You know,
You put this hour with us, you know?
But, you know, it's like, this is why this is important for me, because I could actually stop what I'm doing for a second and just, like, this is the only conversation that I've had over the last few weeks. Where I'm having these conversations every day. I'm on webinars and different shows, but this is the only one I didn't prepare for. And that's just a beautiful thing. Like, I don't have to like get up at, I was up at 5 for different reasons, but I don't have to get up at 5 o'clock just to prepare. I can just talk and think with you. And, you know, you're my heroes, you know, seriously. And at one point we have to talk about your show, because I realized, you know, after I interviewed you for my book, I went back and I listened to like the first 2 years of every episode. And
that's where those stats came from. Okay. Thank you for digging in the archive.
Well, you know what I realized? That is exactly it. You have one of the most important archives in the history of social movements, of popular culture, and specifically Chicago. Like, I was trying to look for sources. I'm like, it's right there. And I should have done that at the get-go. So now my book is really heavy. But it's beautiful stuff. I mean, I'm just never, ever eliminate that archive. It's amazing what it captures.
I'm overwhelmed. I'm not going to cry, but but I have goosebumps. To hear that from you, I can't fully express how much that means, because, you know, that is the intention, is that as doing it, and sometimes you don't know if it meets that mark, and we call it an archive, but, you know, you are one of the greatest living historians of our time in general, but especially of the Black radical tradition and liberation at large. And so, yeah, that is the highest praise and highest compliment. So you put me on my heels. I'm going to let Daniel jump in. I had a first question based off your intro, but like, I need to breathe that in. How does that resonate for you, Kiss?
No, it's crazy. It's absurd. Yeah, no, it's exactly what we made it for. You've done a wonderful job. I know you said you didn't prepare, but you certainly prepared to knock us over, because that was in real time. Part of what we were making it for was, we would say like 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now. And now it's almost 10 years. Like, we want the thinkers, movement workers, and we would say like, writers, historians, academics, to have this be a living archive to understand what was happening in the city in that moment. So I didn't know we'd be doing it long enough to get to hear that feedback in real time. But that's really a delight.
We're going to put that as a blurb.
You know? No, you should use it.
You are the ultimate blurber. So I will go with my first question based off just how you checked in. So you are so gracious with your mind and with your time. I see you and follow how you show up to so many spaces, so many texts, so many projects, and offer this historical perspective, offer beautiful language, offer this really humanizing framing for basically any conversation that's happening within the ecosystem. You are so accessible, and you mentioned that you have to prepare, and that you didn't have to prepare for this conversation, so you get to exhale a little bit. I want to talk about that preparation process. When you say you have to prepare for an interview, for a conference, for a forward, what does that look like for you? Is it a gratifying process? Does it feel like a burden? Does it feel like a superpower that like you have to live up to the responsibility of? What's your preparation process to how you present to space?
Well, you know, it's all of those things. Like interviews, for example, like I'm doing more and more of them because of a lot of different things are converging. And there's a certain artifice, because I have a terrible memory. I am not a very organized person. For a historian, I have a bad memory. I have to keep notes. And when you hear me talking on a podcast, and if I'm just like rolling with all this stuff, it's because I was up at 3 rereading, reorganizing, getting my thoughts together, laying it out. And I have like a little note in the corner of my computer, where I'm just like looking, talking as if I'm just talking off the top of my head. You know, it's like, it's an artifice. And it comes with age. Like, I'm an old person. I mean, I have moments. One of the worst experiences now, which is why I don't do a lot of book signings anymore, because, you know, I know a lot of people, thousands of people. I've had so many students and so many colleagues and so many political people that I've worked with over the years. And then I would do a book signing, right? And people would sign, line up, and then I would see their face and I would know them. So I started a conversation to try to, you know, like, yeah, so how you been? Like, how's your
kids? Because you have to write to... If you know, they expect you to write their name in the book.
Exactly. God. Because some people take it for granted that I already know them. And I do know them. I just
you do? Place, hey.
I can't place the name. So then I'm like,
I'm never
stalling.
Writing a book. That was the last. Yeah, you just, that's solidified. I'm letting go of that dream because that
it's
is my
funny.
Nightmare. Oh my God.
So what I've been doing lately, like, it's like before I would even sit down, I would say to the whole audience, I said, look, I'm an old person. Even if you're blood related to me, tell me your name. Even if you're my child, tell me your name.
Just a little just reminder, you know? Yeah, that's great.
So that's kind of like a snippet for what's involved for me, because I'm not a pundit. Pundits are people often who are quick on their feet. They throw out opinions, but they're not backed by much. You know, I feel like if I'm going to talk about something, I have to have evidence, backing, you know, solid material things that people are not thinking about. Because if I say the obvious, that's not helping anyone. So I end up digging deeper. It benefits me, and I think it benefits all my projects, because digging deeper means that now I know more, I have more material to deal with, to introduce into my courses, into my writing. And it's part of why I love what I do. And that is, like, I'm the constant student, always trying to figure out things, learn things from the grassroots, you know? So that's really what it is. It's just that I keep, when someone asks me to do something, they'll say, oh, well, can you write a foreword to my book? And I'm like, oh, of course. That's going to be like 2 years from now, right? Or a year from now. And what happens is if I do that like 5 times in a week, then that 18 months comes and those 5 things are due.
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time.
They figure out how to converge on themselves, don't they?
Right.
I once heard someone say, if you ask me far enough in advance to do anything, I'll say yes. And if it's on my calendar for that week, no matter what it is, I don't want to do it. Both of those things are true at the same time, you know?
Exactly. That is exactly true.
So not to be a nerd, because I really want to get into more of your story and more of like how you found yourself in this place and position. But we've joked a few times about forwards, and I actually want to like dig into the art and the significance of what a forward and a text is, because you are the forward king.
Right.
I think there was a day, and we happened to be on a portal call that Barbara organized like a day or two after, and I hit you in the chat. There was a day I just sat down. I have about 15 books that you wrote the foreword for, right. And I just like read 4 or 5 different forewords in a day just to kind of like hear your voice and like see how you move through things. And like when I see a book that I know either you're on the front or on the back, it's like, oh, I should probably buy this. I should probably check this out. And so, you know, one, the like, the tension of saying yes to so many things and like, where does discernment come in? But the actual, the form, the medium that is right. The forward, what does that mean to you? What is the significance? Why do you take it on so much?
Right, right. You know, I think it's true. I think I have the record for the most forwards.
Yeah, forwards, you're like Lil Wayne or Snoop Dogg. Like,
yeah,
the most features in the game.
You know, and it's a really great question, because there is a certain, I don't want to call it an art, but there's a purpose. And, you know, there's sort of 3 kinds of forewords. There are those that are for historic texts that have been lost, that are being revived and brought back. So like I wrote the foreword to C.L.R. James's History of Pan-African Revolt, which was published in 1938. I mean, things like that. I did a foreword for the Communist Manifesto. People don't realize that. You know,
big flex.
I might be the only Black person to ever do that. But so there's that, there's like the framing project, that is understanding where this book came from and why it was significant then, and more significantly, why we need to read it now. And then there's forwards to texts that I really believe in the book and the author, and I think they're trying to say something of significance. And so that's also, it's not just promotion. It's like trying to let the reader know ahead of time that what you're holding in your hand is precious. Don't skip a page. Pay attention. Build on that. Because I write forwards to books that are asking people to do something, that are requiring something of us besides just you know, being able to talk about this book at a party. And so, you know, people call me hyperbolic, maybe so. There's some truth to that, but except for the fact that my hyperbole is true. I live in a world surrounded by brilliant people, and I love that. Like, I don't have any, like, I'm not competing with anyone. I don't have any professional jealousies or anything. I just feel like I'm surrounded by so many people. If you ask me to write a foreword to your book, you don't think I'm going to say yes? Because that's a connection, you know? And it's the same thing with writing liner notes. Like, I write a lot of liner notes for albums, CDs. And I write a lot of liner notes because the artist, you know, is doing something for which there are no real great words. You have to kind of hear it. But if I could find some words to give it some context, to lift it up, that's what I do. I love doing that because, you know, we underestimate the genius around us, underestimate just how brilliant the people are around us. We keep wanting to go back. Like, remember the days back in the 60s or the 30s or the 1860s? You know, right now in this moment, there are people who are, most people are way smarter than me. And if I could have the opportunity to sort of lift them up, especially young people, that's what we do. And so to me, that's what a foreword or afterword is supposed to do. Give a political lesson, frame the project itself, put it in context, and remind people why this is important, why you need to read it and understand it, or why you need to listen and listen carefully.
I'm wondering how those intentions line up with how you think about your scholarship and teaching really overall. Like, are those similar intentions to what you do in a classroom and in your own writing too, of like, look at the genius of this, look at the importance of this, and really engage?
Absolutely. Yeah. To be fair, I do two things at once. One is uphold and lift up the genius, but also always sharply critical. Those two things, as far as I'm concerned, are acts of love. Criticism is an act of love, which you don't, like, I try to get my students to understand, my graduate students especially, that a critique is not meant to bring anything down at all. On the contrary, a critique is meant to try to see the things that are not on the page or the things that the author might open up for us. And then from there, move forward. Now, there are some things that deserve critique because they're just abject and just reactionary. And, you know, and we have to critique it because it becomes a kind of common sense. Some things are just straight up fascist and we have to call it out. And that's a different kind of critique. But to me, in the classroom, I try to get people to pay attention to what the core elements or arguments are, what they can learn in terms of their current organizing work. And for me, the classroom is not, like, I'm not trying to, I don't try to create, like, a generation of objective scholars. I'm not going to lie. You know, I try to make radicals, because that's what we do. As Marx said, and as Angela Davis has repeated, to be radicals go to the roots. It is to penetrate all the outside, all the onion skins, pull them back, and get to the heart of the matter. Even if, as Marx said in 1844, even if getting to the heart of the matter contradicts everything that we've ever thought, you know, and that's what it means to go to the root. And so when you do that, you get students who say, you know what, this world is not the world I was learning AP US history. That's not that world. This world is totally different. It's totally messed up. And so there's a lot going on.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think that breakdown of what we mean by critique is really important. I want to stay on this idea of the liner notes for a second, as someone who, this is such an old person conversation for me to start in this too, but I have a real appreciation for that form. And I think it's so different from how we think of, like, you know, music criticism or the Pitchforks and the Rolling Stones of the world. Like, there is this kind of, like, poetics that's implied sometimes, and it's an incredible form. And so before I get to, like, how you think about it for your own writing, what's the iconic liner notes for you, of the ones that you just, like, oh, they really did a thing that complemented, added to, enriched the album that came alongside of it?
Well, that's a hard question, because I haven't read many except for the ones I write, which never go anywhere. Right. Because, you know, people, they download the record, and so no one's going to read the liner notes. And I've written some I'm so proud of, I'll give you an example of one of mine, then I'll talk about another one. Well, James Brandon Lewis, who's an amazing tenor saxophonist, he is a composer. He did an album of music dedicated to George Washington Carver. So each song was building on Carver's work. You know, he had studied Carver. And so my notes were basically taking each song and then digging down into Carver's history as an artist, painter, botanist, scientist, socialist, to kind of meld together what he's producing musically with how he's honoring Carver. You know, so stuff like that. But as far as liner notes go, I mean, I could tell you who I think are great, great writers of liner notes. But and again, this is jazz. Amiri Baraka. He's written some notes that, I mean, first of all, Amiri Baraka is, you know, he's such an amazing writer, such an amazing person who's able to take the vernacular language and penetrate. And his writing is like a bomb, like it just blows up in ways that really just open up things. The same with A.B. Spellman, who is he wrote an amazing book called Four Lives in the Bebop Business, and he's written some amazing notes. And then there are musicians who write notes. I mean, if you read like John Coltrane's notes to A Love Supreme, which is a kind of deeply meditative spiritual statement, which kind of explains how his journey to the music. So stuff like that. You don't have much space. In fact, I just wrote some liner notes for Chick Corea, one of his last thing, recordings. And it requires, I mean, this is him playing Mozart. So I had to go, and Gershwin. So I had to go dig into some of the music he was, and went back to the original scores to figure out the degree to which his playing is in line with the score itself, or where he, you know, diverges from it. I mean, you know, like just writing liner notes, just writing like a thousand words, sometimes requires like a deep study into the music.
That's beautiful. I want to pick up something else you named right after you talked about the liner notes of like the work you do in the classroom about creating radicals, basically being a guide on this path to the roots. I want to give you space to unpack what that process really means, because I can imagine four or so like ways that goes or paths that can take. So there's one, like the ultimate of someone who's kind of ready and open and receptive and positioned already in a way where they want to expand or have a respect already built in for liberatory traditions and are eager to learn and grow down that way. Secondly, there are folks who are just like present, maybe are more or less just an empty vessel and you're able to pour into, and they didn't know that they were about to go down this journey, but are willing. Third, I can imagine folks that like kind of finesse of like, I'll go down here with you, but are disingenuous and like are still going to continue on with their liberal or liberal conservative ambitions. And then fourth, I imagine that there are like some steadfast, staunch resistance. And so I'm curious, when you say, you know, what I'm doing unabashedly and without, you know, secrets is working to create radicals, but you're doing it in open space. And that process, it happens outside of the classroom, as you know. Organizers, artists, media makers, many of us are working to try to help people become more radical or create more radicals. And so for you, as somebody who's been doing this for a few decades now, like, how does that process go for you? And what have you learned about the mechanics and the nuances and the joys and tensions and struggles of creating radicals?
Right. Well, on the last point, I bring in the artists to do that work for me. So they come into my classroom. Both, I used to start all my classes with some music before anything would happen, you know, to get people settled, to get them to pay attention. Sometimes poetry, Jane Cortez, you know, I'd play some of her stuff. But to go back to this question, yes, there are different kinds of students. I teach a lot of first and second year undergraduates. And I teach a huge class called History of Neoliberalism. I get like 400 students. And my goal is 10%. If I get 10% of the students to really think hard, it's the original 10%er, right? You know, 5%. I'm trying to get 10%.
You're up in the ante
here. I'm not trying to get 5%, 10%. And so it's true. Sometimes the students who are really, really active in movements feel like they already know everything. And I could get them. I mean, you know, part of it is that, you know, I would challenge them on things that they think they know. Then there are those students who just want to get a grade. And every once in a while, they'll be moved by something. One of the funniest things that ever happened, I was teaching at USC, and it's a brother too. I mean, first of all, you know, at USC, when I taught there, like, I would say more than half of the Black male students were athletes, which is a shame, you know, when you think about the structure of the university. So this one brother, he wasn't an athlete, but he comes up to me at the beginning of class and says, you know, so Professor Kelly, what's the least I can do to pass the class? I said, come again?
Buddy, that's an inside thought. That's not an outside thought.
I have a lot of sympathy for that approach, but to say it out loud is not...
First of all, the class is called Black Movements. And he says, what's the least I could do? I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, I'm taking the class pass fail. And I don't want to like have to, you know, if I do a lot of work and I, you know, get a good grade, it'll be kind of a waste. I said, okay, let's back up for a second. I said, why do you want to work that hard? He says, what do you mean? I said, do you know how hard it is to work toward mediocrity? You know, mediocrity is like you have to work really hard to get down there without falling off the cliff. Like what you want to do is want to be mediocre and not fall off. That is just way too hard. Like, why work that hard? Like, why don't you just do something simple? Like sit in the class, take notes, ask questions, do the reading, take the ride, enjoy it. Challenge me, you know, challenge your peers. And you know, he was scratching his head, but I have to say, at the end of the class, he came up to me and he got it. He actually got an A in the class. And he said, you know, Professor Kelly, thank you so much for saying that because it never occurred to me. He said, like, now I realize that we're here not for the grade, no, but that we may learn something. And I'm like, well, welcome. You know, and I was thinking, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. You know, it was like a really important lesson. And that's one lesson. And forgive me, but I think the anecdotes actually say more than kind of general philosophy. I had another student I was teaching at USC, taught a course called Jazz and the Political Imagination. And I played for them a song called Triptych, which is from Max Roach and Abby Lincoln. It's from the Freedom Now Suite. And so you hear like Abby Lincoln screaming, just shouting and screaming and shouting and screaming. And the music is in the background. And so this brother, again, young Black man who's on the football team, he's sitting in the back and he's like, man,
and this
why
is
you
USC football
that? That's
team.
Not
this
music.
Is like,
yeah, USC. Yeah, USC football team. Right. No, these are high level. And he's like, that's not music. Like, what is that? I said, well, you know, she's trying to express an emotion of the moment. This is 1960. And sometimes there are no words. There are no words. Sometimes it's only utterances, sounds. That avant-garde jazz is in about kind of freeing the imagination, but also expressing not just joy, but anger and pain. And that's called triptych. Because triptych is like the last part is like freedom. In any case, I said, well, I'm gonna convince him. I said, so next day we come back to class 2 days later, and I said, well, today we're gonna watch a film about Emmett Till, and so we watched this documentary about Emmett Till, and this is back in the days when you could actually show images of Emmett Till without being called to the provost office for, you know, traumatizing students, right? So by the end of the film, the same dude is in the back crying. His tears are coming down his face. And he comes up to me and he says, I understand the song. And that was it. He says, I understand the song. Like that's the teaching moment. That's the thing that I strive for people to understand the things that are not easy to understand rather than showing me that you've done all the reading. You know, that was one of the most magnificent moments for me.
Well, that's where I would chime.
My
understand it without doing all
teaching.
The reading. You would have loved me. That's all I bring is understanding and not doing reading. You know?
Star pupil over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, front row.
No, I'm sorry. No, you got to come correct, come true, because you wrote a brilliant paper at the end of your senior year. You know that because we talked about that, and you had some great mentors out there in Iowa. You know,
you're so sweet. we do a thing here. We offer gas and affirmation, and we tell people what they mean to us. And I want to do that and kind of do it repetitively through the rest of this conversation. And I know the only thing that matches your brilliance is your humility. And so you may be uncomfortable, but for the sake of the exercise, I need you to receive it and like run with it and not reject. Because from afar, you mean so much to me and us.
No, I'll do the best I can. Luckily, I took my Wellbutrin this morning, so I'm good.
Yeah. You got to take it. So from afar, you mean so much to me and to us and to the larger us and we, in terms of framing this sacred tradition for us to see and understand and recognize. And for me and so many of my peers that we have, you know, given so much of our lives to and come to understand ourselves through and meet the people that we are closest to. And it would be so amorphous without thinkers like you, framers like you, spirits like you that pour so deeply into unearthing that which is not seen or appreciated in the right way, but also putting together the context. And like you said, with your students, that deeper meaning, that's not really about the philosophy, but about the real human truth. The Bogs say truth is not to be proven or discovered, is to be created. And you have created so much truth for us. But then on a personal level, like knowing you has meant so much for me knowing myself. Like I met you like 6 to 7 months after Freedom Square. Yeah, just, you know, the gracious of like allowing me to come to your office and just have a conversation. And you left me with a book and have kept in touch. And every time we see each other, have like poured in love and poured in affirmation. And it is tough sometimes to know where you are in this forest. And you help say like, yes, that this is a path. Like it's not just wildness, right? So I just want to thank you because I feel so much more confident and grounded and connected to this larger tradition from knowing you and knowing Barbara. And it really, really means a lot. And you have meant a lot to so many. And you also have done such a good job of being known by who needs to know you, while repudiating and rejecting like the celebrity intellectual position in a way that I really respect and admire. So the way that you move through the world serves as a model and serves as a compass of how do we take up the responsibility of like, we have to say some things, we have to lead, but it's not about us. So thank you so much for that.
Wow, thank you. I didn't expect that.
Yeah, no, you deserve it and so much more.
No, that's really beautiful. But, you know, of course, it's mutual. You know, it's like you coming into my office is like a celebrity coming to my office, you know, given all that. Seriously, because I've learned from that moment on, and I've known Barbara since, I've known her more than 30 years, you know. We've been really good friends, and I was on her dissertation committee. But one of the things that you all did in Chicago, and I'm learning this now, is that I don't think there's a more important city in this country in terms of its opposition to fascism and police violence, but also creating a cross-the-board kind of multi-generational, youth-led, international revolutionary movement with Black leadership. I mean, Chicago is the model. And, you know, people would hold up Fred Hampton and the Rainbow Coalition, which I think needs to be held up as really the best of the Black Panther Party. But what you all did from the Let Us Breathe Collective, We Charge Genocide, Asada's Daughters, BYP 100, I mean, we can go on and on, is create the most dynamic political movement, I think, of both 20th and 21st century in any city. And I could prove it. I mean, I'm not just saying that.
I was about to say, I'm trying to prove it in this book. What are you?
Yeah, no.
Look, I've been studying social movements for 37 years. You know, left movements. You know, I wrote about the Communist Party in Alabama when people said that no such thing existed. There will be many, many generations that's going to study Chicago from that moment. I would say roughly 2012 to 2020, but especially that moment in between. It's an amazing thing, and you're historic.
I tried to serve you up some affirmation, and you volleyed it right back at me, and like, now I'm on my heels.
You did it again. Yeah. Very effective rhetorical move. Yeah. Incredibly insightful and incredibly effective rhetorical move.
So thank you.
It is true.
From that affirmation, from that context of what you mean to us and to me, I want to trace when you first saw yourself on this journey? Because from my historical understanding, and you may not accept this, you were kind of like a prodigy, intellectual, academic, and like left organizing space. Like you were the young buck that everyone was like, whoa, who is this dude? And like, and so if one, you can correct or reframe that if that doesn't feel true. Were you a red diaper baby? Were you provoked in some type of way? Was there an act of state violence that reshifted? Was there a moment of rebellion or uprising that got you? What is the seed that got young Robin into becoming the Robin D.G. Kelly that we all know today?
Oh, sure. Black women. I mean, it's very simple. Black women. So my mother and my sister Makani Temba, who many people know her because she's an organizer and stuff. She's my older sister, 18 months, 10 days older than me. You know, just the short version is, you know, I grew up in Harlem. We left when I was young, like 10 years old. But being in Harlem in the middle to late 60s, it was an amazing moment. I was not a red diaper baby, but politics was everywhere. But our politics was both local and international. You know, like my mother, I remember my mother participating in protests at our elementary school, PS28, because the school was overcrowded. We'd had like, you know, 45, 50 students in the classroom designed for 28. It was underfunded. This was a time of struggles for community control. And my mom wasn't an activist per se, but she was out there. She was supporting progressive teachers. And we went to protest with her. I remember going to the United Nations in some kind of protest. I don't remember what it was exactly, but you know, and my mother's from Jamaica. She was at the time single because she had gotten a divorce. You know, in living in a tenement apartment, my sister, me, my younger brother, and my mom. And my mom was like this deeply spiritual person. She wasn't a Christian. She was a follower of Self-Realization Fellowship. So she would like meditate. She would play the harmonium. Some of it was kind of spooky, I have to say. No. But one of the things she was able to do was convince us that our poverty didn't define us. And she would never say we're poor. She would just say we're broke, which is to say it's a short-term thing. And then she would turn our little den into these amazing spaces. Like I remember, you know, when she didn't have money for like Christmas, she would fix our toys. Back in those days, you used to have this thing called contact paper. And contact paper is like, it's like wallpaper, but you could put on anything to make it look better. So she would take raggedy trucks and put contact paper, and there would be like a red truck would look new. She found stuff out the trash. She found a sort of frame for a bed, pulled it into the house and made a couch out of it. You know, we didn't have money for food. And so she'd be have like, you know, we're going to have breakfast for dinner. We're going to have eggs and potatoes. And that was like something to look forward to. Like, we're going to reverse the day. And so she never, ever sort of said, you know, like she never complained about anything. She just did what she needed to do and made sure that we understood that we lived in a beautiful moment, in a beautiful house with beautiful people, and stuff was good. And my older sister was the one who taught me how to read. You know, she would come home from school, she would share her books, and she taught me to read. And she became my political mentor because she was the first one to come to the Black Liberation Movement. She was the first one to come to Marx. She was the first one that, you know, and she would bring that stuff to me. And I remember by this time we moved to California, and my older sister, she's 2 years older, so she started college and I'm in high school, right? And I would go visit her. And I have to say, my objective was to try to meet college girls. That was it. You know, I was like pretending to be like, I would say like, no, I'm a student at Cal State Long Beach or whatever. And even though I was in like in 11th grade, her presence at the university and the things that she shared with me got me interested and inspired me. I would not say I was a prodigy at all. I was just zealous when I got to college because like I'm sure you had this experience before. You go through life, you're thinking, okay, I'm trying to get paid. You know, I want to have some kind of, you know, nice car, nice whatever. And then you take a Black Studies course. And it is like I'm not very religious, but I could understand what it means like when you get saved or when you have the Holy Ghost. It was like the Holy Ghost. And then you're mad because it's like, they've been lying to me. And then you feel like I need to know more. And for me, because I'm not that smart. I have to work really hard. So I'm like in the library 24/7.
I got to pause you. I'm sorry. This is a beautiful story. But this is the thing that you do this and I can't accept it. Like your brain works it. I watch you in space, and I don't care if you woke up at 3 a.m. and wrote the notes down. The way that you're able to use a specific paragraph from a specific page for a reference to make a point that is so dense, but then comes through so simply. I feel like this is a device you use to stop people from being intimidated by how smart you are. I'm calling you out. I can't take it anymore. You are a genius. So when you your brain works in
it. It wasn't a question, Robin. It's less of a question, more of a comment. You know, when people throw that move.
Well, you know, see, for me, I'm like more of an autodidact. You know, I just taught myself a lot of things. And when you do that, your education is really uneven. And so for me, I'm sitting in the library. Someone could figure something out in an hour. And sometimes it takes me 3. I'm getting to the library when it opens and I'm leaving when it closes. Like obsessed. I'm reading as much as I can. And so all that work eventually becomes cumulative. And then I could sort of synthesize and think about things. But I have to say, nothing came easy for me, you know, because of that. I think that may explain why I have a certain kind of empathy for those students who don't have like the classical background, who don't have like what we think of as the foundations of education, and can recognize their insight, intelligence, and the things that they're striving for. And so that was for me. I mean, and my mother, who's I think brilliant, she didn't have a high school diploma. My mom's story is funny because, you know, her best friend in high school was Fran Beal. Frances Beal, we know, she's one of the leaders of the Black Radical Congress. She was one of the founders of Third World Women's Alliance. She wrote an amazing essay called Double Jeopardy, which is really one of the key texts around thinking of gender and race, right? And all this time, you know, my sister and I didn't know that the Franny that my mom was talking about from high school was the same Fran Beal. So they came up together, and then we actually reunited them. Come to find out, they were living in the Bay Area, just like a mile away from each other, all these years, and hadn't seen each other since like college days. So my mom dropped out of high school. She comes back, and as an adult, after her kids are growing up, she goes back to college, gets her degree, gets into Berkeley, gets in the PhD program in ethnic studies. She's studying Native American history, Native American studies at UC Berkeley. She has a stroke in 2010, so she never finishes. But she is very much the autodidact. Like, in other words, she's like self-taught and moves through the world like that. I try to follow my mother's footsteps. Although, a funny story though, when she took her first graduate course at Berkeley, they assigned my book, Race Rebels. And so her job was to comment on it. And
nobody gives loving critique you know.
Right. And she's like, well, I should admit, yes, this is my son, but I never read the book. So now I really need to dig down and read it. So she had some good criticisms for it. But it's like, that's the world that I understand. And that's why, like, one of my favorite books is a book called Lessons from the Damned. And it's a book that doesn't have a particular author. The author is listed as the Damned. It's a book that was produced as a result of political organizing by a group of Black women who were very grounded in community outside of New York City. And they got together, the people that were organizing, asked them to write things. From a 12-year-old girl to a, like, 80-year-old man, you know, all Black people living in this neighborhood, I think it's New Rochelle. And they produce this book. And the book is beautiful because it combines experience, speaking from the heart, with collective analysis, a shared research. And they provide a critique of American fascism and racism and capitalism in their community. It's one of the most astounding books. It's out of print, and we're trying to get it back into print. To me, that's the work. That's what I mean. It's like, that's the kind of work that both I feel like I'm a product of in value, which is not the same as being brilliant.
I'm hearing this base of autodidactic kind of tradition, this like learning in space and community and like, you know, outside of academia and the traditional contours of intellectualism. And then you have this almost like Mamba mentality of hours in the gym and getting shots up in the library that then accumulates and then, you know, forms your thinking into this way. And then there has to be a moment or a season or a path of like, oh, I'm interested in these things. I have this background. I have my sister, which I also relate to, that kind of is like this guide of the type of person I am already, or at least how I orient myself to the world. But then there has to be a moment. It has to be before the Black Radical Congress. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was some communist parties in there where you're now taking this background and this tradition into real political space. From what I see, it had an impact in those spaces. And you also continue with this like criticism and ethic of study. And so, yeah, when did the learning go into activation and like, oh, this is not just things I'm interested in or the type of person that I want to be, but like, I'm going to be in this world more or less for the rest of my life.
Right. 18 years old. First year of college, I take a Black Studies course that first semester. And as a result of it, fell into certain circles. And I could tell you, the circles are important. I met a brother who was an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party. And this is an organization that associated with Kwame Ture, or people know Stokely Carmichael. We brought Kwame Ture to Long Beach State, which was the most amazing thing. I mean, I sat and listened to him. I think I was 19 years old. And I've never had to hold on to a chair listening to someone speak. I mean, I was literally holding on because I thought I was going to be blown out the auditorium. He was so powerful. And then, so I was part of a study group that he organized. It was just, he could have been one of the greatest preachers of all time. So we were reading a lot of, the AAPRP study group was consisted of me, one other person, and his brother, Chewbacca. We were reading C.L.R. James, Walter Rodney. We were reading Kwame Ture, Kwame Nkrumah as well. And this was all outside the classroom. And then I was part of another study group organized by a visiting professor named Mary Hoover. Come to find out, she was part of Cedric Robinson's circle in the Bay Area in the early 60s, when they were like inventing Black studies before Black studies even became a thing. And so I was part of her study group. And so a lot of the learning then led to organizational stuff, becoming involved in Black Student Union, and then being recruited into, by the time I was 20 years old, I think, 19 years old, I joined the Communist Workers' Party through my sister. She'd already joined. We all had come to the conclusion, late, of course, that Marxism had something to offer, that it wasn't just enough to be a nationalist. At the same time, we didn't want to leave the nationalism behind. And so we felt like there's a way to meld those things together. I mean, it's not an accident that All African People's Revolutionary Party was my first foray. And that was an organization that believed in nationalism and socialism and internationalism. And so by the time we got involved in CWP, it was one of the few communist organizations with a lot of people of color, Asian, Black. I mean, I won't start naming people, but there are a lot of prominent people now in politics who will say, oh, no, that wasn't me. You know, but I learned, but I own up to it. I'm like, I'm proud of the fact that I was, you know, in a Communist Workers' Party. I'm one of the few people who brag about it.
Put it on your LinkedIn, you know?
Right, exactly. That's gonna be right. I should put it. I had never thought about that. But that was the work and the first real organizing project that took up a lot of time through the CWP was working on Jesse Jackson's first presidential campaign. I have to explain this because it's hard to see the value of it in, say, 2024, when in 1984, it was extremely important, not because people believed in Jackson, not because people believed he would become president, but it became a space for us to organize a new Rainbow Coalition. It's not an accident that the Rainbow Coalition of Chicago, that idea that Jack O'Dell, who's a name that people should know, labor organizer, he was King's right-hand man, he was also a former communist, brother, Black man, that Jack O'Dell kind of introduced the idea of a Rainbow Coalition to the new Jackson campaign. Jack O'Dell was the one who convinced Jesse Jackson to connect with the PLO, with Palestine, to connect with Gaddafi in Libya, which people think that's a joke, but it's not a joke. If you go back to early 1980s, Libya had a very, very important role in our own movements internationally. So working on the Jackson campaign was important because we thought we were building a new left, a multiracial, Black-led left out of that movement. It didn't quite happen that way, but that's what we're striving for. That was probably the most work I've ever done besides the anti-apartheid movement, actual direct organizing. And then got to graduate school and continued. You know, I was involved with the African Activists Association. A lot of it became much more international, African-oriented. I was working on South Africa for my dissertation. Since I didn't get into the country, I ended up switching fields to U.S. history and writing about communists in Alabama. But I have to say, even the intellectual work came directly out of the organizing work, because the concerns I had came out of the organizing work. And the biggest question I kept having was, how do you build a socialist movement that is actually attentive to Black people's needs? And I don't mean just like anti-racism. I mean to our culture, to the way we organize, to the way we move in the world, so that we won't have to leave anything behind. And even though I'm not very religious, I try to write about in the Hammer and Ho and about the Communist Party, is how people brought their prophetic traditions, their religious traditions, into a movement that's supposed to be secular. And that kind of synthesis, I saw it happening in the movements we're trying to build. But more importantly, this is where the second most important mentor in my life besides my mother comes in, and that's Cedric Robinson. And I was a grad student at UCLA. I read Black Marxism, you know, almost accidentally, because it was sent to us. I was a book review editor of our journal, Ufahamu. I read it, and I was like, oh, wait a second. Everything I thought was just wrong. No, and I can't say I understood the book the first time I read it or the second. By the fourth time, I kind of got it. By the seventh time, I really got it. By the 10th time I read it, I really understood what was going on, to the point where I have to defend him from all these misreaders. But the point is that I reached out to Cedric. I have to give him credit for this. He didn't have to take me on as a student. I wasn't even at UC Santa Barbara. I was at UCLA. He didn't have to give me time of day, but he modeled for me what I try to model with my students.
Not even your students. The way you made your office open to me feels very similar to how you didn't have to give me the time of day either.
That was Cedric. Cedric was like that. Just very generous and open, and also very engaged. One other thing I learned from Cedric, when I give talks and stuff, I'm not really interested in people like snapping their fingers and, you know, saying amen. When people do that, I feel like I'm failing. When people are really quiet and thinking and scratching their heads in a good way, I feel like I'm succeeding. That is, raising the questions that are not being raised. And that's how Cedric was. He would correct me and critique me in ways that made me like scratch my head. Like, I'd never thought about it that way. You know, like, I'll give you one concrete example. I sent him an early chapter of my dissertation on the Communist Party in Alabama. You know, gave me a lot of feedback, a lot of critique. He said, you know, tone down your editorial voice. You don't need to sound like Marx or C.L.R. James. Like, don't write like them. You know, basically, don't be so sarcastic, because, you know, that's what we do. But the most important insight he gave me was, he said, you know, you got to understand that the Communist Party had a lot of like immigrant radicals who came to the country, you know, late. He wasn't dismissing them. He's saying that, but they didn't understand that the South was the center of American radicalism. And I had never thought of it that way. He said, the South, he's like, look at Reconstruction. The masses, the Southern Black masses, were the most radical working class element in the United States of America. And I never thought about it that way. That changed everything for me. You know, so things like that, you know.
It's doing it again, that sentence, that idea. I mean, this is less in the life story, but more just that's a really interesting insight. Can we talk a little bit more about that and where that understanding like is heterodox to how like traditional labor histories are taught about the States?
Yes, no, definitely. Traditional labor histories tend to center like industrial workers. Even today, when people talk about the unions and politics, they act like the unions are all white. Understand that. You know, historic industrial unions are most important. White workers, immigrant workers are at the center of it. And what Cedric taught me, he learned from Du Bois, from the book Black Reconstruction, which I'm teaching right now. And what Du Bois basically said was, the movement of formerly enslaved labor to make America a true democracy it was the most important labor movement in the Western Hemisphere. And part of it was, what does it mean to redefine the worker as someone who might be working in rural areas, someone who might be a domestic worker, someone who might be doing things that would be servile? He said, but these are the people who are often the most radical. They may not be organized in formal unions, but they have other forms of organization. And so that lesson that Cedric got from Du Bois, he passed on to me. And so when I wrote Hammer and Hoe, yes, there were lots of unions in the story, but most people don't think of rural and urban, but especially rural Black workers, sharecroppers, tenant farmers, agricultural laborers, as the vanguard of any revolutionary movement. And what I found, like, the sharecroppers union formed by the Communist Party had like at one point 15,000 members. Could you imagine 15,000 members, all Black, in any organization? And this is across the board, like mostly Alabama, but also, you know, Louisiana, Mississippi, but mostly Alabama. And they are having shootouts with police in 1935, 1933, 1931. That history was totally submerged.
Yeah, we think it started with, you know, Bobby Seale and Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that was the first time that that type of resistance came about. Do you think it's cultural shame of, like, the mores of Southern life that that gets erased? Or isn't as celebrated? Like, there's something about the Black jackets and the, hey, Jack talk of, like, Oakland and Chicago that is, like, more sexy to us? That, or is it film and, like, the way in which the history is archived and you have to go back and, like, an archive papers and books to get these
right.
Knowledge. Why do you think we are so, that's so erased from our memory?
I think all those things are true. And I would add one more thing, and that is the American ruling class has worked really hard to erase the legacy of Reconstruction. And that's why, like in Du Bois's book, he has a chapter called The Propaganda of History, chapter 17, where he says, look at how people have kind of turned this moment of democracy, abolition democracy, into a farce. So Birth of a Nation, the film, is the first major epic film. What is it about? It's about proving that Black people were actually the problem, incapable, when they came into office, and that the Klan saved the day. Then you get all these Confederate monuments. Then you get Gone with the Wind. Then you get like this whole mythology around the South. So Black people become backwards. White people become the victims. Or even the idea of white people as the masters and brutal and vicious. That's even problematic because we don't actually see the extent of Black resistance. And when you think about Oakland, there's no Black Panther Party without Louisiana. Because that's where people came from. So you got Alabama, where the Black Panther Party idea is rooted, Lowndes County, which Lowndes County happened to be a stronghold for the Communist Party, by the way, in the 30s. But then the migration of Southern Black people to Oakland, that's the radical tradition. The migration of Mississippi Black people to Chicago makes Chicago a radical space. Like the migration of Alabama people to Detroit. These are all the radical spaces of working class rebellion, and it all has Southern roots.
And it's not even necessarily generationally divided. Like, it could literally be the same people, you know, maybe their kids, but like it, within the span of an adult lifetime.
I'm thankful to you and to Cedric, that legacy, for opening that up in my eyes. Your work, Barbara's work, she's working on a book too. And, it, you know, not to give too much about it, but it's like, how do we build a revolution? And what I push her to name and say is that she has been doing it, and you have been doing it. And, you know, if revolution is a process, if we see it as not being generationally distinct, and so if we go back from Reconstruction and see that there really are no gaps in the history, like there is a continuum through each year and each decade of this process of recreating this place and recreating ourselves and going to the root of the structures, your unearthing of this story or these stories and framing it in the ways you do in Freedom Dreams. So Hammer and Hoe to Freedom Dreams, kind of as somewhat of a continuum, has been so revolutionary and has helped me again understand and know the tradition that we are in. And so, yeah, I just want to, one, claim that, right? That you, that Angela, that Ruthie, that Critical Resistance, the Black Radical Congress, we don't talk about And that was one of the gaps. So like one of our kind of pseudo research questions, we first started doing this of like, okay, we kind of know what happened from 55 to 74, but from like 1980s till 2014, it feels like radicalism disappeared. And one of the major efforts of it was y'all creating the house where we can learn from it, where we can name it, where it is institutionalized, where we can study it in a formal way, where those histories are not erased and forgotten. And so, yeah, I want to name that history is revolutionary, but the stewardship and the framing that you have been so instrumental in is also a revolutionary gift that has made our thinking and our tongue so much more adaptable to the environment and the evolution that we need to take.
Right.
So no question, just thank you.
But can I just say, okay, let me just, you're going to do the thing.
I know you're about to do the thing. You're going to do the thing.
No, let's hold, because I should do this. Let's hold up Barbara Ransby, because we're talking about history. All of her work is amazing. Her first book on Ella Baker, I have to really hold up, because I call it a biography of a movement. You know, Ella Baker is one of those figures. I mean, of course, we know Barbara is Ella Baker reincarnated. You know, I mean, literally, she does what Ella Baker does, which is to say, she pays attention, she steps back, she's a great organizer, she knows, she understands the landscape, she listens. But what she did in that book on Ella Baker is so amazing, because you could read that book and understand that long trajectory going back from Reconstruction to the early 20th century. You understand all the movements she was a part of. You understand the intersection between her communism and her kind of nationalist-oriented politics and her feminism. And it's all combined together. And only Barbara could have done that. And that is to submerge not just herself, but to understand what it means to both lift up Ella Baker, but also understand her in the context of a broader movement. That book is essential reading for everybody.
We'll put it also, as we like to do, in the show notes and also on the Ergo reading list, which has a couple of your tomes on there too.
And shout out to Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement turning 20 this year. And what a beautiful celebration that was, that day that we were able to have at Barnard and the folks that were able to come together. That was another one of those, like, you know, I say it all the time of like, oh, these moments keep me in it. And like, I will remember them for the rest of my life. And so having you there, Miriam there, Angela there, it was so amazing. But Daniel, take us where you want to go.
And having you there.
Yeah. I got to pop in.
I'm going to open a can of worms. You know, Dame, you framed it as like part of what happened in that time was building the houses so that we could ask these questions and have, you know, a deeper understanding of the lineages and of the world. This is, you know, it's a hard pivot, but it's something that we're doing on and off mic in our days every day right now. And I feel remiss to not open the door to talk about Palestine with you, partially because some of my understanding is rooted in conversations that I've heard you have, in things that, you know, Dame and I have talked about that come, you know, things he's learned from you. And obviously there's like 15 conversations that we could have, and some of it is already tied to what we're talking about. But part of what I'm hoping this show can be doing right now is being a point of kind of intervention in a historic thought, or in things that are being shared that are not rooted in what we know to be true. I'm going to just kind of leave it open of like, what are the things that you feel like we need to get on mic, we need people to hear, in our understanding and our positionalities in relation to the genocide in Palestine in this time? Because I think you have a brain to help us understand this moment.
Thank you, Daniel, for doing this. Real brief, you know, in the 2012, 2014, 2016 moment that you celebrated and named, there was a way in which we looked at the 60s and 70s and the Panthers and urban rebellion as like a parallel and a guide. And so as you answer the question and how Daniel framed it, one thing that I'm seeing is that the work of the 80s and 90s of the anti-apartheid movement feel like that similar historical corollary that informs how folks are shaping or speaking to or showing up to this moment. So that might not be true as a parallel of like the 60s to the 2010s and anti-apartheid to now, but I feel like I'm seeing that as you kind of open up where these things land for you.
It is absolutely a parallel. I mean, there are direct relationships between the anti-apartheid movement in the 80s. In fact, Palestine was an issue then. The First Intifada and the anti-apartheid movement emerged around the same time. And it's not an accident, for example, that South Africa is the country bringing the case against Israel for violating the Convention on Genocide. So, you know, that connection is direct. But let me just add one other connection, and that is 2014 to now. Because that moment that you all were in, like when you were in Ferguson, 2014, the Ferguson Rebellion coincided with the 51-day war in Gaza. And a lot of people in St. Louis were themselves activists around this question of Palestine. Some were Palestinians. And what it did was it opened up the question of genocide, which people were not raising when it came to Palestine directly. Fast forward 2 years later, the Movement for Black Lives puts out the 2016 document, which is like basically just like this huge, really important intervention on like, where do we go? What is our program? And in that document, it lays out a charge of genocide directed at Palestinians. Now, the Movement for Black Lives got so much flack, people pulling money. And what it did was it forced a debate within groups like JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, which I'm involved in as well. And that debate was the richest, most dynamic thing because it brought the question to the forefront. And a lot of JVP members who were kind of holding on to Zionism to a certain degree had basically become anti-Zionist and had begun to embrace the concept of a genocide, whether it's a slow genocide, whether it's a cultural genocide, whatever it was. We could not have this debate had it not been for 2014. In other words, the question had been opened up by that period that you all represent. And part of what happened was between 2011, you know, and this came up at the conference for Ella Baker, 2011 to about 2016 or so, there were all these delegations of young Black people going to Palestine, going to Ramallah, going to Nablus, and seeing for themselves and coming back and seeing the relationship between these struggles. So here we are, 2024, you've got the South African case before the ICJ. You've got another legal case in Oakland, California right now, charging the Biden administration with facilitating the genocide. And even if it doesn't go anywhere, the language is out there. The concept is out there. The threat is named. And now I think what we're going to see in the next few months, next couple of years, is on the one hand, a continuation of this genocidal war, but on the other, a more robust opposition. So as you know, there's this case going on up in Oakland, the U.S. District Court, against the Biden administration. What's amazing about it is that the judge was actually sympathetic and said, you know what, there is something like a genocide going on. Unfortunately, they had to dismiss the case because of jurisdiction. That's the only reason. But the fact that the ICJ court and this U.S. District Court would show that there's something happening opens up a lot of doors. The outcome for American politics, that's another debate. But right now, if it wasn't for, I think, we're talking about decades of organizing, and some of it coming from Black freedom movement, we wouldn't be here being able to raise these questions about the genocide of Palestinians. I'm pretty confident about some long-term outcome, which is the end of the occupation and a free Palestine.
That cumulative work we're recording, in addition to it being the day after that ruling came down, it's also the day after Chicago passed this resolution calling for ceasefire here, which was a long road, a remarkable organizing feat, and, you know, a politically fraught moment in terms of how this will be weaponized next. But in naming it as an important political statement, if we understand the cumulative work of organizing that then, you know, a result of that was the election of this, you know, kind of critical mass of progressive to radical city council people, leading to that, the election of a mayor who at least feels accountable to this power base behind him and then is put in a position to cast that defining vote. You know, that's one microcosm of what you're talking about, of this cumulative work. Any other thoughts? Yeah, no, go ahead.
The symbolism of Brandon Johnson casting that vote. You know, no matter what you say about Brandon Johnson, if that's his legacy, I'll take it. That's a huge thing.
Yeah, that's a whole, I have all kinds of thoughts on how the political maneuvering that I'm sure was done to make sure it came down to him. Being the, you know, so this all of a sudden becomes a referendum on him and his stance and how that can then be used. But in and of itself, a significant moment. But beyond the scope of here, is there any other like point of intervention in how you're seeing the left talk about this moment in Palestine that feels worth like getting on mic right now, if this is a thing people will hear?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing is what do we do? I think that it's important to continue to support boycott, divestment, sanctions, because it works. It's important to recognize that ceasefire is just the beginning, and that what we need to do is insist on the end of occupation, because what we're seeing now is a move on the part of this right-wing Zionist government to basically reoccupy Gaza and to continue its ethnic cleansing. And so there's a lot of work to be done in the long run, as long as we don't do what happens all the time. And that is, people forget Palestine unless there's killing. You know, whenever Gaza's bombed, then people jump into the fray. But when it slows down, people sometimes forget. So I guess my most important appeal is that we continue to center Palestine and Palestine's freedom in our struggles.
That was, I think, the last thing I wanted to make sure we got a second to talk through. Let's get on out of here. Dame, any last gasp of praise here?
Just Robin, that I love you and so many love you, and the way that you pour into movement, the way you pour into liberation of all people and particularly oppressed people and Black people, the way you show up for your comrades and the way that you show up for movement and value everyone in the room in a way that's, it could be easy almost by accident for someone in your position to move in a way where everyone doesn't come away feeling that, but that, you know, when you're not around, this is how people speak of you, and that you have such an impact. And so I really admire and look forward to being able to approximate some of how you show up and occupy space, like just you being somewhere, just you saying a word, just your name being attached to something, it moves mountains. A quick anecdote, right? Like you connected me with Amanda Seals, and I ended up, you know, being on her show while she was in town for a couple of nights. And I told her, I'm like, oh, wow, you really got the right people. Like Robic asked me to do something whack, and the answer would be immediately yes, right? And so you never have, or, you know, I don't foresee it, but just your credibility and your card or your stock and your name has so much value. And it's not just because it's a name. It is because of the spirit that is always attached with your name. And so thank you so much for doing all that you do. Thank you for taking some time and sharing some of your wisdom and brilliance and ingenuity with us again.
Well, thank you so much. And I promise I'm going to stop right there. You know, I can come back and say the exact same thing.
Look at this. We're all learning and growing.
I appreciate all you do. Yeah, no, I appreciate all you do. I appreciate Ergo. I think, like I said, come back to the archive. The archive that you have is the richest archive. And I just hope people could pay attention and go back and listen to those shows, because every show is quality and brilliance. Thank you. I'm honored.
How can folks find you and your work in the ways you want to be found?
I don't want to be found.
Read a book.
There you go. Good enough.
I'm kind of joking, but kind of not. I'm kind of not.
Unless it's some shit that needs a really hot forward, stay out of that email, you know?
Right.
Read a book.
Right. I heard that.
We're at Ergo Radio and at Respair Media. Make sure you subscribe, comment, all that good stuff, review. Go back in the archive. If Robin said it, it must be a good idea. And we'll be back soon reshaping the culture for the more liberatory and creative.
Much love to the people.
Peace.